Okay, so first of all, before I really start, two typos, two mistakes in the homework assignment. First one discovered, second on question number one, by Juan, the diagram here should be connected. Okay? Second one further down, discovered by Chris Atkins, there was a trace missing in the original version. Okay? What you're seeing now is on the web, so it's already corrected. Okay? Second, today we will follow a handout, and here it is in front of you. If you don't have copies, can you pass around? But before that, before we get to the handout, we have to do something, a few other things. So let me remind you where we were. Well, we want to compute this path integral, and the definitions are, well, given a one-form, a Lie algebra-valued one-form on a manifold, the Chern-Simons form of A is given by this quadratic plus cubic thing. The holonomy of a connection along a path is given by this iterated integral formula, which solves a certain differential equation, but you know, at the moment, that's all we care about. And then we define the Chern-Simons or the Chern-Simons invariant of this path gamma to be the path integral of e to the Chern-Simons times the holonomy. I guess here I also should have put the trace in some representation. Divided by the vacuum path integral, so by the path integrals that you would get if you didn't have gamma. Okay, just because then all normalizations go away. Okay? I gave sort of wrong heuristics for why this should be a sum over trivalent diagrams, and it's wrong because the whole Gaussian integration paradigm breaks because the quadratic form is not invertible, is hugely not invertible, right? It involves the differential d, and d has a kernel, right? The image of the previous d. So no way it's invertible. However, the reason it is not invariant is precisely, sorry, the reason it is not invertible is precisely because of the image of d, or more precisely, because of gauge transformations. Gauge transformations act like the image of d plus a higher order correction. Okay? So we need an aside, and today, all of today is this aside to discuss how to integrate things that have invariants. And the title is Fadeyev Popov. It's the Fadeyev Popov procedure. Let me tell you what it is. So first of all, here's the picture. We have a function L, which we want to integrate. I don't know why I called it L. L is actually e to the I times Chern-Simons. Maybe it's not a good day name. Anyway, we have a function that we want to integrate. And the function is invariant. Sorry, sorry, sorry. No, the function is everything. It's this and the trace of the holonomy. Okay? The whole thing is the function. We have trouble integrating it because it is invariant under the orbits of a certain group action. Okay? Let's suppose that the group is some group called G, so these are the orbits of some G action, and let's assume that the Lie algebra of this is Gothic G, and I guess, what do I want to call the generators? So I think before I used to call the generators X sub B, in other X sub A, in some other context, so I'll still call them X sub A. Okay, though it's not the same Lie algebra. Right? I mean, so the Lie algebra that appears here is some finite dimensional Lie algebra, and the corresponding Lie algebra to this one is some huge infinite dimensional Lie algebra, the Lie algebra of gauge transformations, okay? Of infinitesimal gauge transformations. So, you know what? So maybe I'll use a different name. So, let's call it Gothic G sub A. These are just the generators. Okay, now, okay, how do I integrate it? So, the impossibility to integrate comes because the fibers are big, and we want to integrate over the whole space. So, the idea is we choose a section, okay, and integrate only over the section. Now, how do you specify a section? So, one way to do it is to find a function f into some auxiliary space such that the section will be the set of zeros of the function f. So, there has to be conditions, okay? The conditions have to be that the set of zeros intersects each orbit exactly once, and probably you need it to be transversely, and no, that's it. Okay? But anyway, let's think a little bit. If the group is of dimension 17, the orbits will be, well, okay, so let's also assume that the action is free. So let's assume that the action is free. And this is nearly correct in the case of gauge transformations. In the case of gauge transformations act almost freely. So up to some finite, so it's an infinite dimensional gauge group, but up to some finite dimensional thing, it acts freely. So it's almost correct, so we're not making a big mistake. Okay? So anyway, assume that, so now let's look at it in finite dimensions and pretend that the action is free, and the group is 17 dimensional. Then the orbits are 17 dimensional, so the section should be of codimension 17, right? The surface defining the section should be of codimension 17. How do you make a codimension 17 surface? You map into a space of dimension 17, right? And then the zero sets will be of codimension 17. Now, which space is there around us of dimension 17? Well, the Lie algebra itself, or the group, okay? So, I may as well assume that f is defined by a function into the Lie algebra. So, the zero set of f is this section. There is supposed to be a handout. Maybe we run out of copy. Oh, I can give you my copy. Okay. So now, here is this Fadeyev-Popov theorem. So, the integral, so I forgot to write that L should be invariant. And, ooh, I should have said also that the group action should be preserving the measure. Okay? So, the claim is, so maybe I should have written, you know, L times dx is invariant. The measure times the integrand is invariant. So, the claim is that the integral of L, dx is equal to, so let me first write something incorrect and then slightly correct it. Okay? So it's equal to the integral of L times a delta function at f of x. So L of x times a delta function at f of x. Okay? I mean, right? That's exactly what it means to pick one point from each orbit. Except that's a little bit wrong. And the reason it is a little bit wrong is that it's actually non-obvious. What does it even mean to compose a delta function with a different function? So for physicists, it's completely obvious. I mean, they just don't think about it. But for mathematicians, you know, the reasonable way to view a delta function is as a distribution. So it's functional over, again, functional defined by integrating it against smooth functions. Okay? And when you think about it in this sense, what does it's not at all obvious how to define delta of f of x. Okay? So, instead of defining it formally, I will I'll do something informal and it will get the right answer. Okay? So really what I want to think is how to compose it with the delta function. Okay. What are the values of the delta function? I suppose it's a real valued function. So, well, I don't know, generalized real valued function. Okay, so what we will do is we will approximate the delta function by some bump function where the width of the bump is epsilon and the height of the bump is also epsilon. Okay, and then the delta function is really the limit of, sorry, and all of this is happening at zero. Okay, then the delta function is the limit as epsilon goes to zero of this.
The height is epsilon?
No, the height is epsilon inverse. Sorry. Okay. So the delta function is the limit of this as epsilon goes to zero. Now, what does composition of f with delta sub epsilon b? So instead of having support this line, it will have support a narrow band around this line, and on that narrow band the value will be 1 over epsilon. Now how narrow is the band? Well, it's roughly of size epsilon, but the precise size will depend on the differential of f. Namely, if the differential of f is small, so if f varies slowly, then it takes f of x a long time to exit this epsilon interval around zero. Okay? So, you know, sometimes you'll have like bumps here. Okay, so again, this is, you should think of it as being very small, but I'm drawing it so that it will be visible. So places like this are places where the differential of f is small. Okay, and then elsewhere you will have places where f is the differential of f is very, very high. And then the band that you will have here will be narrow. So this is df is big. Okay? Now, that's wrong. It means that orbits that pass through places where df is small are overcounted. You know, you spend more time on these orbits, so you count them way way too much. In fact, how much too much? Exactly by the size of the F. And likewise, the other orbits are undercounted, and again by the size of the F. So if you want to correct it, what you have to do is to put the size of the F. Now, I wrote it as if it was one-dimensional, but F is really a high-dimensional thing, and the orbits themselves are multidimensional. So the correct size measurement is a certain determinant, and it's the determinant of, okay, so now let's add coordinates. So F is really F up A, where A is the runs from one to the dimension of the Lie algebra. Okay? So I should be putting here the determinant of df sub a divided by, sorry, 2, the derivative of moving along the orbit, right? I want to differentiate f relative to motion along the orbit. So dfa to dxb. Okay? Does it make sense? So all I'm asking is that it will make sense, because I will not prove it. Okay? And why will I not prove it? Essentially to follow an established tradition. So I've seen kind of proofs that work on the level of manipulating delta functions without ever giving a proper definition of what the delta function means. Okay? But the physics textbooks, the Fadeyev Popov, all places where Fadeyev Popov is defined, is stated, well, say, given that delta of f of x is never properly defined, the proofs are not much more valid than the proof I've just given, than the explanation I've just given. So I'm not happy, but that's what I can do. That's what I have. Okay. And then there is a minor further step. And the minor further step is that the delta function in itself can be Fourier transformed. So the delta function at the point, sorry, the delta function at the point zero as a function of x, in general, is the integral e to the I x y dy. I think we've used this at some point. Okay? So I can rewrite this as the integral dx and then dy, where x runs on the original space, but y is a variable that is, oh, you know what, let me just first of all write the integrand. So it's L of x and then e to the I y f of x. So y should be dual to f of x for this to make sense. It's not a single delta function, it's a delta function on a Lie algebra. So y runs on, well, the Lie algebra or the dual of the Lie algebra, depending if you're using the metric or not using the metric. But anyway, times, I still have to copy the determinant, dfa to dxb. Okay? So that's what I want to, okay. Now, why is this good news? Because, you see, if f of x looks like, well, has a non-degenerate differential, okay, then this whole part looks like y times some linear functional, oh, no, I cannot use L, so sometimes linear functional of x. So that's quadratic in the integration variables.
Right.
My integration variables were y and x, and this is a quadratic expression in the integration variables, plus there is a perturbation. F of x is not going to be linear, it's just going to be approximated by something linear. So plus perturbation. Now, if we are lucky, or if we are choosing our section properly, then this quadratic piece plus the quadratic piece coming from here will be non-degenerate. And overall, we will have something that to which we can apply perturbation theory. Now, the perturbation that will occur here, the extra thing, well, we know how to deal with perturbed Gaussians. But then the news is that we have to learn how to deal with determinants. Okay? So, yes?
When you go to the previous formula, so it looks like on the left-hand side you integrate over the whole space, but on the right-hand side you integrate over this one slice. Shouldn't you also integrate over the orbit?
No.
So it looks
no,
like...
I'm integrating over the whole space still. I'm integrating it, so I want to restrict to the slice, okay? But the way I restrict to the slice is by multiplying by a delta function. So I'm still integrating over the whole space.
This integral is unchanged of each function.
Yeah, but we still have to count this integral.
Oh, you are right. I should be multiplying by the volume of the orbit.
Yes.
By the volume of orbits, yes. So the claim is that how should I say that? This factor up to a single multiplicative constant, which is some related to the volume of the orbit, this factor related to the volume of the group. Okay? So a different way of saying the meaning of this factor is that it measures, so it also measures the difference between the volume of the group, the ratio between the volume of the group and the volume of an orbit. Because you see, so you're right, this is only up to a universal proportionality constant. So you see, if an orbit is big, it's because you are moving quickly along it, right? Which means that differentiating with respect to moving along the orbit will be small, I suppose. Wait, is this what I'm doing? If an orbit is big... No, sorry. If an orbit is big, then differentiating, then you move quickly around along it. When you trace the action of the Lie algebra, then the Lie algebra as will define tangents to the orbit which are big, and then this derivative will be big. And that's what you wanted. So you've multiplied the delta function by the size of the orbit, by something proportional to the size of the orbit. So maybe I should have said it earlier. So really, this determinant fixes two things. One is the size of f, and the other is the size of the tangent vectors, the it depends on two things, the size of the differential of f, but also the size of the tangent vectors and tangent to the action. And the size of f is the issue that I've highlighted, and the sizes of the tangent vectors are those volumes of the orbits. Maybe it's best if I give an example, okay? So let me give the simplest example you can imagine. So, or, well, I don't know if it's the simplest you can imagine, but a simple example. So let's look at, sorry, the action on R2 of the circle group by rotations, okay? And let the function f, so the function f determining the section will be just the function y, okay? So the zeros of y are the x-axis, okay? So actually, unfortunately, it intersects every orbit twice, so we will be overcounting by a factor of 2. But I'm only asserting proportionality up to some volume of the group, so it's a minor issue. Okay? What will Fadeev Popov tell us? It will tell us that that if you have an invariant function into, I guess, the complex numbers, it doesn't matter, then the integral of that invariant function over R2 is equal to the integral of L times delta at zero of y, okay, times the determinant, but it's a one-by-one determinant in our case because the Lie algebra is one-dimensional, so times the determinant of, well, the derivative of f, so dy, to relative to the action of the Lie algebra. So it's dy d theta to the action of the group. Okay? Now, this is an ordinary delta function. So this is really the integral dy, L evaluated, sorry, dx. If you put delta function on y, you're left with integration over x. So this is integration dx times L of x times, okay, what's dy d theta? So if you differentiate y, well, I mean, I don't know, you have to compute it. What is y as a function of theta? So if x is equal to r cosine theta, y is equal to r sine theta, dy d theta on that line is just r. So you get times r, and this is just the usual Cartesian to polar change of variables. Okay, so I don't know what else to say. Okay, I mean.
No, and I think in this proportion also the factor 2 pi is missing.
The factor 2 pi is the volume of the group.
Yes, exactly.
So I admit it, I'm missing the volume of the group. Okay? So, but the volume of the group is a single constant. It's one thing which I allow myself to miss.
Oh, and this constant, okay, is equal to infinity.
Well, yes. So that's how we made sense of an infinite integral, or we replaced it by something that makes more sense. Now, if you wish, the constant, so at the thing that at the end I will measure is this, okay? So the integral divided by the integral without the knot. So the volume of the group will cancel. Okay? So, yeah. Now, you can be more careful, and people are more careful elsewhere, and they insert factors corresponding to the, you can insert factors corresponding to the volume of the group. You have to decide what the volume of the group is when the group is the group of gauge transformations. And there are various zeta function regularizations for products of infinite things, for determinants, for infinite dimensional determinants. People do that and get meaningful results, but we don't need to do it. Because first of all, I just don't care about overall constants. Okay? Good. Sorry. So next, okay, so the moral is that I need to retract and understand integrals of perturbed Gaussians times determinants. A new story. Okay? So the handout I gave you is partially the old handout, slightly rewritten. Okay? So about the old perturbed Gaussian integration, and I'm not going to go through it, I'll just remind you that after doing various calculations, Fourier transform, blah blah blah, we got a sum over pairing, which be pairings, which became a sum over Feynman diagrams, and that's it. But now I want to compute a new integral, which depends. So it's depending on which depends on a constant epsilon, a quadratic form, a cubic form, a matrix, and another set of matrices. The integrant that I care about now is the integral over Rn of a quadratic perturbed by epsilon times a cubic times the determinant of some fixed matrix perturbed by epsilon times a matrix that depends on x. And again, I'm taking the simplest possible dependence, so I'm just taking a constant matrix and multiplying it by xi. So I get one constant matrix for each coordinate, and so basically I'm looking at sort of the first order approximation to a matrix which is a function of x. So it's a constant matrix plus epsilon times a matrix that plus something that linearly depends on x. Okay? So if you want to switch to the language written here, used here, then Q is the value of this determinant at zero, at some point zero, where my Gaussians will be centered, right? L, the functional here is now a Gaussian, so there is some specific point where it is centered. And then I also add its first order Taylor expansion. Okay? Now I should say that I've used the first order Taylor expansion. That was not significant. I mean, we will not need more than that in what we do. But we could have used more than that with no. I could have put higher order terms here with no difficulty at all. The changes will be minor later on, and I will tell you what they are. Okay? Now, the physicist do this, compute this determinant by so-called by introducing so-called ghosts and fermionic Berezin integration, and saying that determinants in themselves can be interpreted as Gaussian integrals. In fact, when we did Gaussian integration, we got a determinant. Except our determinants were in the denominator, and now we want a determinant in the numerator. So there is an alternative theory of integration, which is this anti-commuting integration or Berezin integration, but I want to do it later. Because my experience, when I learned about this Berezin integral, it looked like black magic. And I don't know, has anybody learned about the Berezin integral before and noted it as a black magic thing?
No.
Okay, so I don't know, you're... To me, it was always black magic, and I wanted to understand it in terms of ordinary mathematics. So I want to first explain it in terms of ordinary mathematics and then switch to this black magic. Okay, so my next task is, well, to Taylor expand this. So suppose you have a matrix plus, and suppose it is invertible, and you add to it epsilon times another matrix. I want to find what the Taylor expansion of this is as a function of epsilon. Okay, I want to find a power series expansion of this. So I need a little bit of us and our side. So here's the claim. The determinant of Q plus epsilon P, well, let me divide by the determinant of Q. I mean, so really, you know what, maybe I'll write it here. The determinant of Q plus epsilon P is equal to the determinant of Q inverse times the determinant of, so I'm dividing by Q inverse, by Q, so I get 1 plus plus epsilon Q inverse P, right? And over here, I pulled out I've multiplied by the determinant of Q inverse, so the first terms are drops.
I think the first determinant.
Oh, sorry, the first term here is the determinant of Q. Sorry, I pulled out the Q. Sorry. So up to this overall constant, I need to expand the determinant of the identity plus epsilon times another matrix. Okay? Now, let's look at it a little bit. So we have the identity matrix, right? And we have lots of other terms that are different than 1, or different than 0, but they're all proportional to epsilon. Okay? What will be the term of order k in this? How can I get epsilon to the k out of this? Answer, well, I mean, what is determinant? It's a sum over permutation, it's a sum over rook arrangements, right? I have to put rooks on this big chessboard, and then multiply the things underlying. So I need to take from exactly k of the things, I need to take the epsilon, right? So in exactly k of the factors, I need to take the epsilon, and from the remaining factors, I have to take the 1. Okay, but the ones only appear on the identity, sorry, on the diagonal. So the conclusion is that these boxes in which I take the epsilon must come in matching rows and columns. So maybe in row 2, in column 2, in column 3, and in column 5, I will take an epsilon. But that means that I will also have to take So the rows of these things will also have to be 2, 3, or 5, and 5. Because the complementary things, the complementary sets have to be equal. Okay? So really I have to sum over all subsets of size k, right? So for each subset of size k of the index set, I have to sum, so the contribution of will be a sum over choosing out of the of the set of indices from 1 to n, choosing k of them. Looking at the, so I don't know, let's call this choice I. So looking at the I by I minor of the matrix, and, well, I'm multiplying by epsilon to the k, and there might be signs. I'm not careful. Okay? But if you look at, but what is the, okay, the matrix of k by k minors is exactly the matrix for wedge k of, sorry, these are minors of, not the original matrix, but of the perturbation matrix of, let's call this B. So these are the minors of B. So these are exactly the entries of wedge k of B, of the kth wedge power of the matrix B. And I'm taking the same, I'm taking the same subset, minors corresponding to the same subset of indices, but that just means that I'm taking the trace of wedge k of B. Okay? So that's the next formula here. So this is the sum as k is greater than 0 of epsilon to the k, the trace of wedge k of this matrix here. Okay? Now, what is the trace? Oh, sorry, what is the trace in wedge k? So trace in wedge k is the same as trace in tensor to the k, except you have to project to the anti-symmetric things. So so you also have to sum over permutations, insert minus one to the sign to the insert minus the sign of the permutation, well, divide by factorial, and look at the trace of the original the kth tensor power of the matrix you wanted, composed with the permutations that permutes the tensor factors. Right, this is just the projection to the anti-symmetric things. Okay? And then here's a graphic way of writing this. So graphically, well, I will think of a purple line as a line running in, well, the well, so remember that sort of always when I interpret diagrams as tensors, lines get assigned an index. So each line here gets assigned an index running from 1 to the dimension of the matrix. I think elsewhere I call this dimension 1. So there is a number running from 1 to d on each of these indices. Okay? And then I permute the tensor factors. This is what sigma does. And take a matrix entry, or, you know, well, multiply by Q inverse and then multiply by P, and do it on each cycle. So that's the kth power of Q inverse times P. You know, if I wanted to be more precise, you know, if I wanted to correspond to our diagrammatic notation more closely, I So maybe I'll just interpret one such diagram. So so let's take you know a case where k is equal to 2. I have a q inverse here, a q inverse here, a p here and a p here, and I took the transposition. Then the convention for how to interpret this as such things as matrices, as tensors, is to put indices on the arcs. So I have to put an inter-index I here. I persists until it meets Q, until it gets to a vertex. Then I'll have to put, I guess, I1. So then I'll have to put I2, then I3, then I4. No, sorry, this is still... Then I4, and now I'm done. Okay? And this will be interpreted as P evaluated between, so this is a P. So P evaluated between I4 and I1. Then another P evaluated between I2 and I3. Then a Q inverse evaluated on I3 and I4. A Q inverse evaluated between I3 and I4, and then a Q inverse evaluated between, where's the other Q inverse here? I1 and I2. And then I have summation, and this just amounts to saying that I'm multiplying the matrices in the order that they appear along the cycle. So this is just, and then taking the trace, because I sum over all indices. So this is just the trace of whatever it comes to be, Q inverse P, Q inverse P. Okay? And this is one of the terms that will contribute here. Okay? So, and there is only one extra thing that I've added, and this is, instead of multiplying by -1 to the sine of a permutation, the sine of a permutation is, well, if you use a cycle decomposition of the permutation, the sine of a permutation is just the number of cycles up to an overall minus. So it's -1 to the size of the permutation group times the number of cycles. Okay? So instead of writing -1 to the permutation, I just wrote -1 to the number of cycles. Now, the number of cycles is also the number of purple components that I will get if I insert sigma in. Okay? So I just need to count purple components and put here -1 to the number of purple components. Oy. I'm running out of time, but my next step is to replace this determinant by its power series expansion. So this is this trace of sigma of, well, exactly what is written here. Yes?
In that thing you just calculated, will sigma contribute anything other than a sine?
Sorry?
In that example, will sigma contribute anything other than a sine?
Well, it contributes this.
But I mean, you're going to go q inverse p anyways.
No, it's the number of, so had this been... had this been the identity permutation, then instead of being this trace, it will be the trace of Q inverse P times the trace of Q inverse P. That's not the same. Okay? So you'll have one trace from this cycle and another trace from this cycle. Okay? And in fact, in general, you know, you could write a formula. I didn't, but you could write a formula over here in which instead of a sum over permutations, you do a sum over partitions. Okay? And the partitions tell you what component, I mean, which, how many sizes of each length you have, cycles of each length you have. Okay? So I could have replaced this formula by some sum over partitions of k, so I guess lambda will be a partition of k. So lambda is in itself a sequence, lambda 1 up to lambda, I don't know what, q, such that sum lambda I is equal to k, and I guess we can make it decreasing, okay? And then you will have a sum over partitions of, for each partition you will get trace of q inverse p to the power lambda I, but you'll be getting the product of this over all i's. And you'll have to multiply by a combinatorial factor. Times some combinatorial factor which depends on the partition. The combinatorial factor is the number of permutations that gives the partition lambda as their cycle decomposition. So, I don't know, there is an easy formula in terms of factorials, but I don't want to risk myself writing it. Okay? So, okay. Anyway, I think it's probably time to quit. I'll just say, and I'll do it in more, I'll have to continue next time, that now all I have is a bunch of polynomials in the X's, and polynomial in the X's, I know how to do perturbation theory too. So I get the old perturbation theory combined with the new perturbation theory, and the result will remain a sum over trivalent graphs, though a different one. So that's all.